I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with a special guest, the other Greg, Gregory Hood. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
If you would like to send a question or a comment to us, there are many ways you can do it, but our favorite way is for you to send us a donation, a super chat. You can do that through Entropy, entropystream.live/countercurrents, all one word, no hyphen. And it says we're not streaming there. We're not streaming there. We're streaming through Odyssey and DLive. You can still use Entropy, though, to send a super chat using your credit card. We've made a lot of merchants unhappy over the years, and we've been blacklisted from the regular credit card processing industry. So there are very few ways that you can use plastic to support Countercurrents. Entropy is one. They stood by us. Cash App is another way you can do it. You can also send us a cash tip through Odyssey. So either way that you choose to do it, we very much appreciate it. We use these as fundraising streams, as well as just community building and, of course, information platforms. Getting ideas out there. It's part of the battle of ideas. But we do need to keep the lights burning. So if you would like to help out, please do so. I wanted to talk to Greg about two things. I wanted to talk about James Burnham and Machiavellianism because he's interested in Burnham and Sam Francis, who was a student of Burnham. But there is an even bigger thing that has loomed up in the last day that's taken all of our attention. And that is finally we got the announcement that Roe versus Wade has been overturned by the Supreme Court. And this is a very important topic. There are many, many sides to it. And I'd like to spend at least 20 or 30 minutes of the show talking about that. And then we can talk about Burnham later. But so let's begin. Greg, I have a question here from one of our longtime donors and listeners, Sutton. And he puts it nicely. He said, what should white nationalists do now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned? So what are your thoughts on this?
On a personal level, I'd stay out of the way. I mean, in terms of getting mixed up with the protests that are out there and everything else, I think the best thing to do is just sort of stand back and let the leftists and Antifa go at it in the streets. I notice now, let's not get ahead of ourselves with the full story of some of these things, but there have been a number of reported attacks on crisis pregnancy centers, places like that. I don't think anyone's been arrested yet, but assuming leftists did that, if they in fact did that, we want them having to deal with the state. And I think identitarians getting out there involved in the street screws up the narrative and the message. And that also splits the movement to some extent. As far as how we should view it, I think that's a bigger question. All I can say is that when it comes to, on a personal basis, I used to be more conflicted about the issue, whereas now I'm 100% pro-life. And I think a lot of that just sort of comes from getting older and also seeing your own kids and everything else and understanding that there's really no substitute for that and that it actually does matter taking a pro-family stance, not just in terms of abortion, but what Steve Saylor has called affordable family formation. I think that's something we should be paying attention to as well, not just abortion.
Yeah, absolutely. My reaction to this, it was spelled out in an article called Abortion and White Nationalism, again, at Countercurrents a while back. I think philosophically, the case against abortion is extremely strong. Life begins at conception. You have a distinct living organism when sperm and egg do join. And it's just not tenable to argue that this is not a distinct organism. And if it is a distinct organism, a distinct human, then it should have human rights. And all the hemming and hawing about woman's rights to choose and bodily autonomy and stuff like that is just not philosophically credible, because your right to choose and your bodily autonomy end when there's another human being attached to you that is dependent on you for its life. And so I think there's a very strong philosophical case to be made for banning abortion entirely. It's not a religious conviction. It's not a religious dogma, the way I argue it. It can be argued on philosophical, rational grounds. Beyond that, though, I do have to note that abortion statistics over the past almost 50 years in America have been one of the few bright trends, demographically speaking. Abortion has delayed the great replacement in America. And that is the primary concern that I have. My primary concern is white demographic decline. Abortion actually is one of the few liberal triumphs that was working in favor of white demographics rather than against it. And so my attitude was, even though it's not philosophically or morally justifiable, it's not a policy, it's not a trend that I would like to spend any of my social capital, any of our movement's scarce capital in overturning. It's just not our fight. However, now that it has been overturned, my view is that, well, fine. I believe in human rights. I believe that as convenient as it would be just to massacre all the people you don't like, we have higher standards than liberals do. And I recognize that people of all races have human rights and they deserve decent treatment. And so I think it's not philosophically or politically permissible for me to go on crusading for abortion rights at this point. I couldn't do that, even if it would help us out. I couldn't do it because I believe in human rights, the rights of non-whites, as well as the rights of the unborn. And so I just have to say, okay, fine, it's over. What good can we make of this as identitarians? What possible rosy outcome does overturning Roe versus Wade have for people who are primarily concerned about white demographic decline? And I guess the main silver lining that I can gain from this is that it is going to be extremely, extremely polarizing and divisive. And it might actually speed up the breakdown of the current system. That is one positive sign I can see. What are your thoughts on that?
Obviously, there's a couple major things you brought up there. One, as someone who's rather skeptical of the idea of rights, generally speaking, abstract rights, I would say, though, that the case you're outlining flows logically from egalitarianism. When I was working in mainstream conservatism, that was basically a 101 in how you sell the pro-life position. And I think that's also why the polling on this is going to be a little confused, is because there are a lot of people who may not be socially conservative, but are pro-life, but they come at it via the rights-based doctrine that you just outlined, where it doesn't matter what kind of person it is, doesn't matter if there's developmental disorders, doesn't matter anything beyond the fact that they're human and therefore they have a right to life. And that is something that I think a lot of younger people who may be left-wing on everything else, you could argue, break on this issue or are consistently leftist on this issue. Another thing I would bring up is that what we're going to end up with in most states, obviously, is probably what we see throughout most European countries, where there's going to be restrictions in maybe the first trimester. That's the time you're allowed to do it. It'll vary by state. But we're not going to see the cases that everybody's spending a lot of time on now, the cases of rape, the cases of incest, the cases where the life of the mother is in danger. Those are the ones that are always talked about in this debate. And they're just not a very large number of abortion cases out there. The broader question is, do you as a society adopt the norm where you're essentially separating sex from family formation? And while not being prudes about it, because unenforceable and everything else, I think you want that broadly established as a norm, that affordable family formation and having strong families go together. So it's not just a question of what's our position on this or having a hot take on it or anything like that. But if we won, if we had a society when we were setting the rules, what kind of norms do you want in that society? As far as the courts go, as I brought up yesterday, one of the things that Peter Brimelow has been writing about for some time is that the Constitution gives the legislature the power to impeach judges. And this is just something that isn't done. You can even say which laws the courts are and are not allowed to look at. And the founders, or the framers, I should say, really intended for the first branch of government to be the most powerful. I don't think they could have foreseen political parties in a situation where the people in the legislature actually gain an advantage from not having to deal with these issues. and just saying, oh, well, the court said it, so there's nothing we can do about it now. I mean, arguably, the Constitution fell apart with Marbury versus Madison. I think that because the court is being delegitimized in a lot of people's minds right now, especially on the left, it puts them in an interesting situation because the main social transformations that took place over the last half century all came from the top down through the Supreme Court. This was never anything that was voted on. If you want to get cute and say, well, the 1965 Act was passed by Congress, well, respond with what happened when people in California opposed illegal immigration with a referendum, and then a court just threw it out, and the state of California didn't defend it. So I think the more that these issues are taken out of the courts and the more that these issues have to be discussed, I find a lot of people protesting yesterday saying, oh, well, it's not democratic. This is actually making it much more democratic because now it's going to be brought down to various legislatures and the people who should actually be making this decision in the first place will be making the decision, not just nine judges. I don't think many people, even those who support abortion, can honestly defend Roe v. Wade as a decision on the merits. The idea that they just discovered this right to abortion in a document that clearly wasn't there. But of course, that's the question of rights, as I began, is a whole nother discussion to begin with.
Right. The left really just pushed a huge raft of social engineering programs through with the courts. They conjured up rights that weren't there, imposed them.
And if I can just make one quick note, I believe it was Revolver who actually has a list of other Supreme Court decisions that I would actually take a look at. And I mean, if you take the left's premise that all this stuff has to be brought down to Congress, I mean, we're basically talking about rolling back the entire social agenda of the left post 1965.
Yeah, and this is tremendous. It's a huge opportunity. And the leftists deserve this. Why do they deserve it? Well, because they're a minority. They basically used top-down social engineering to pass through their progressive agenda without preparing the people for it, without being able to create a consensus for this, without any kind of critical dialogue, without any give and take or back and forth. They simply legislated this from the bench, and a large number of people have not been reconciled to this. Even greater and greater numbers probably are not reconciled to it now. And they've got not a leg to stand on. This Roe reversal opens the door to reversing a lot of the other stuff. Now, it's not the end for progressivism because they could actually try to pass this democratically. They could actually try and build up coalitions and make a case for this, engage in some compromises, et cetera, and bring back some of this stuff. But I think that they don't have the social capital for that right now. And I think they're sort of freaking out because they're so entitled. They have this amazing sense of entitlement. They have basically basked in the fact that they've just been able to enforce this agenda through the courts. And if you question it, they throw you off the social media platforms. And now they're being challenged and they've got nothing in the form of coherent arguments. That's the thing that kind of amazes me about looking on Twitter at the reactions to this. The President Biden or whoever controls his Twitter account tweeting out that this is equality that's under attack, or we've never had rights taken away like this. I guess, you know, forget about the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, right? Or some woman decides to kill her baby so she can go on a ski trip. Equality. It's just empty, stupid stuff. I really think the left is going to have to mature and evolve considerably if they're going to try and reenact some of the progressive agenda through democratic means. And they can start with abortion, but I'm just seeing a lot of hysteria and gaslighting.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that it's coming at a tough time because they said, well, we're now in a point where we can no longer define what a woman is. And so a lot of I know it's kind of cheap, but a lot of the quick rhetorical tricks of, well, men shouldn't tell women what to do, and this is a women's rights issue. It's like, well, women as a concept, you just kind of threw out the window about a year ago, because now we can't even make distinction between men and women anymore.
Right.
So there are no women's issues anymore because there are no women, because women's sports and special ladies' rooms and all these kinds of things are apparently offensive now. So why does this one thing get carved out? And you see these kind of rhetorical tricks about like anyone who can give birth or something, but a lot of it just kind of falls flat on its face. I think this caught the left pretty unexpected, caught me pretty unprepared, because I mean, this has been essentially the one of the few things that the conservative movement really has done right in terms of playing the long game, where they just quietly move justices into place. And I mean, I think Democrats have a point when they say that these Supreme Court nominees basically were asked, what do you think of Roe v. Wade? And they mumbled something about how it was settled law and then overruled it. But I mean, that's the system. That's the system that they derive all their power from, or at least they did as far as these social policies go. So I don't think they're in much of a position to complain. And I think what it does is it kind of demystifies the Supreme Court and just kind of drags it into electoral politics, which, again, I see as a good thing. And the Supreme Court was never meant to be the place where all issues are decided.
Yeah, exactly. So it is kind of galling that the greatest cultural conservative victory in my lifetime is something that's not all that good for white people in the current situation. I wish there were other victories that we could point to that would be objectively better for white people. However, I do think we have a lot to learn from the pro-life movement. And I wonder, what are some of the lessons that we can derive from how they played this game, how they actually brought about this victory? It is kind of remarkable. We do have to look to things that work for examples. How did they do it and how can we imitate it? That's important.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I think a lot of contemporary pro-life activism does come out of egalitarianism. And I question how much of that would necessarily flow over into white identity politics, given that they're always going to frame the white side as being the side against equality. I think you can make a coherent argument that being pro-life is egalitarianism taken to its logical conclusion, as opposed to being pro-choice. In fact, many people listening to this might be pro-choice for those reasons, or at least in exceptional cases. Some of the things they did do right were they obviously didn't reveal what they were going to do until they had their people in position, at least with regards to the law. And I think that perhaps the lesson for those going into law school or coming out is your job is to be good in your field first before you start worrying about any political considerations. I mean, these people got to the Supreme Court because they excelled at elite institutions. I mean, I think, who was it when George W. Bush put up Harriet Myers? I mean, maybe she would have ruled the right way, but who knows? But everything has to be about achieving success where you are now first, and then start worrying about how you can help the movement. Another thing that I think the pro-lifers did right is that they always mobilized on that one issue, and they were very good about making people pay if they crossed them on that one issue. I think we forget how marginal pro-life was even within the Republican Party 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I mean, people talk about the loss of conservative Democrats. Well, it's much harder to find pro-choice Republicans outside New England. And the reason for that is because the base of the party, this became one of the things that come with being a Republican, is that if you're a Republican grassroots voter, you're pro-life, full stop. It just comes along with being the identity of the party. And at some point, you either have to build a third position that can stand on its own, and if not win elections, at least function as a spoiler or as an organizational vehicle, or you have to take over the party to such an extent that, in our case, opposing anti-white policies is just taken as the norm. It's not something that you can cross voters on and get away with without suffering defeat in a primary. And I think there are some signs of that, at least. While it would be very much a stretch to say that Republicans are being pro-white, or that I ever expect politicians to ever do anything like that, or that we can just vote our way out of it or whatever else, I do think that you now see people calling out anti-white policies for what they are among Republicans. And that is genuinely new. You wouldn't have seen that even 5 years ago. So there are some reasons to take hope. And as you say, I mean, I think this is going to drive some of the balkanization and polarization process that may be necessary, because right now you have a deeply immoral system where a lot of people are being forced to live under the rule of a class who considers them worse than foreigners. I mean, we're ruled by people who consider ourselves foreigners in our own country. And the solution to that, the peaceful solution to that, is federalism. And if this leads to more of a big sort and perhaps some breakups of states within the union, which doesn't seem that inconceivable to me, considering how the Democrats already want to bring in DC as a state, the Republicans will have to respond. I think all of those kinds of processes are healthy. And the more institutions that are kind of getting in the way between us and federal courts, the more room there is for discussion of ideas, and the more room there is for discussion of ideas, the better we do.
Yeah, I do think one thing that the pro-life movement has been very successful at is arguing that there's been a silent, unnoticed genocide in America. It's been very, very effective at exposing how normal life can actually coexist with monstrous policies that have led to millions and millions of deaths. And I think the thesis of the Great Replacement, the white genocide thesis, suffers from the same invisibility. It's gradual, it's stealthy, but it's real. And the left can't say no. The aborting millions of babies is just some sort of crack brain conspiracy theory. They're trying to say that the Great Replacement is a crack brain conspiracy theory, but it's possible to bring people around to recognizing that a crime of this magnitude can take place in a society that seems normal and law-abiding and fundamentally decent. And I think that's a huge lesson that we can learn from them. How they managed to humanize the unborn, how they managed to shake people out of the complacency of ordinary life in a society where there's this quiet genocide taking place. I think that's something that we should model our outreach on.
It's a difficult question because obviously, working with the conservative movement for a long time, you would have people, pro-lifers specifically, who would use tactics that other pro-lifers would consider to be harmful or counterproductive. The use of graphic pictures of what abortion actually entails would probably be the most notable example. There were people who would swear up and down that driving around these vehicles with these billboards, with these very tough to look at images and putting them all over cities is the way to go. There are other people who would say, no, that actually drives people away. And I think we sort of have some of the same issues in that there are people who want to focus on extremely graphic, say, interracial crimes or something like Rotherham. The reason Rotherham comes to mind is because of how banal it seemed to the British government when, by even contemporary progressive mores, this should have been a scandal at the highest levels, violation of women's rights, everything they're supposed to care about. And essentially, nobody was really held accountable. Nothing much happened. I think some of the politicians who handled it just kept moving on in their careers as if nothing was changed. And again, it was just the silence that was most terrifying. Now, we're going to see, I think, whether this idea of there being a genocide and people getting behind this and really believing that this is something that happened, we're going to see that put to the test, because most polls show that most Americans did not want Roe overturned. I think that the majority position is probably what's going to end up being opposed in most states, which isn't going to make many people very happy, which is that there's something inherently twisted about late-term abortions that simply doesn't apply to something like, say, the morning after pill. And with our issues, you're also going to get a lot of these kind of unsatisfactory compromises. I mean, there's always degrees of how far people are willing to go, or what is the line that they take to be the principled stand where you're actually undermining our side, or whether you're actually helping it. Because I can assure you, within the pro-life movement, there were debates just as fierce about all sorts of different kinds of tactics.
Yeah, and they did have their shooters and bombers. but they also managed to generally.
I don't think they had anybody like that in quite a while, though. I mean, and it is, I think that that is something worth bringing up is that, and I'm saying this to somebody who is pro-life, but not, this is not my main issue. This is not the thing I wake up every day thinking about. But imagine you really believed that what was going on really was genocide, that you really believed these acts were murderous. And for those who believe that, to consciously subordinate what could have been their natural responses to it and instead play a very crafty political game shows incredible discipline and awareness that even when the stakes are morally existential, you don't have the luxury of self-indulgence in terms of just doing what feels good, in terms of what tactic you might select. And I'm not just referring to violence here, obviously, but I'm also referring to maybe some of the other tactics that the pro-lifers used, which I don't think really got them much in the end. I mean, I'd say the biggest thing that we can learn from them is the sense of discipline and a sense of control and an understanding that what we want to do isn't necessarily what we should do.
Yeah, it's an amazing movement that combined discipline and political canniness with moral urgency. They managed to get both of those things right. And they have had significant success. And it's something that we should definitely want to imitate. I do think that we have a tendency in our cause to have, through your optics, I'm going in, vanguardist types. We've been blessedly without those for a while, although the Gendron thing happened recently. But maybe we're maturing as a movement in that direction too. I hope so.
Well, obviously, I'm not, what I'm saying is not meant to be taken as criticism or calling out any particular person. I don't really can't think of anybody who I would consciously disassociate from except the people who actually think it's a bright idea to go and start shooting at random people as if that's going to win people around to your cause. But I mean, in many of those cases, and I actually say this about the left too, and the broader question of, I guess what a lot of people who are really active in the pro-life movement want to talk about, which is the question of a culture of death. Because I sort of think the celebration of abortion in its most extreme forms and also the kind of nihilism that leads to mass shootings are linked, particularly that when a lot of these cases of mass shootings, one side or another tries to blame it on our political opponents, just because that's what we do in America now. You know, there's a shooting, you wait to see if it's which side or the other, and then you make hay out of it. And it's kind of disgusting. But I think the deeper problem is that there is sort of a nihilism at the center of American life. And whether somebody, political radicalism can sometimes be used to sort of fill that void, but I don't think the people who seize on it believe in it necessarily. It's just whatever happens to be there. And it could just as easily have been an ideology on the other side, or it could have been drugs or some sort of just twisted desire to hurt other people or whatever else. And I think particularly when you look at some of these protests going on now, I'm not saying that the pro-choice protesters are the equivalent of these people, but when you see people openly saying things, because we are seeing this now, mask off moments, saying things like, yes, it's good to kill your baby, or yes, this actually is killing a human being for something like partial birth abortion, and I think it's a good thing, and you don't have the right to stop me. When you start saying, okay, well, what kind of a culture do you get when that's acceptable opinion, and in fact, that's elite opinion, and what is celebrated? I don't think you can totally disconnect that kind of sentiment with the really poisonous climate of self-hatred that younger Americans have to deal with today.
That's really important. I would like to talk about that more. I want to take a question, though, that Cuban American has sent in with $50, which is very generous. Thank you very much. Which of the two for president would benefit our cause more, Trump or DeSantis? You want to take that one first?
Too early to say. So much would depend on how it happened. And frankly, I think there's an argument in voting for Trump if they indict him just because as a signal that they can't do that kind of thing. But where it stands now, I just think it's too early to say.
Mm-hmm. My feeling about Trump is that I really wish he wouldn't run again because he was such a disappointment. And it would be better to get somebody in the office who is more competent at actually doing something besides running for president. Trump was wonderful as a candidate, well, at least the first time out, and he wasn't very good at getting policies across. I think DeSantis might be more...
In fairness, though, DeSantis, let us not forget, although he is making headlines about how he's being governor of Florida, but I believe he was in Congress before this and wasn't particularly, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but he wasn't known particularly as being a hardliner. Whereas it was President Trump who did what George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush couldn't do, which is deliver reliably conservative justices, at least on the abortion issue. I think pro-lifers who voted for Trump, knowing what he was morally, but who said he is openly telling us, these are the people I'm going to look to for judicial appointments. These are the people I'm going to put in, and it's going to lead to the result I want. Those people won. And if you're from our point of view, I think there are a lot of reasons to be disappointed with President Trump, although anything looks better compared to President Biden. But how many of the people who opposed him in 2016 were these sort of professional conservative Christians who self-righteously scolded the voters about how Trump isn't suitable for office and how his character will degrade the nation and everything else? Well, you know, he did more for the religious right than all the other presidents put together. So what does that tell you about the way politics works?
Yeah, it is very, very strange, but that is true. That is true. And the religious right has a lot to thank Donald Trump for. The identitarian right, the people who wanted a wall.
Not so much. Not so much.
Not so much. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to talk to you about Burnham and Machiavellianism. And I just thought this would be a good topic of conversation because you and I have good conversations about politics and political philosophy. And I was reading the Machiavellians, and near the end of it, in the part at the end on politics and truth, there's a chapter where he lays out the principles of Machiavellianism as he understands it. And I just wanted to go through and read some of these maxims and just get your takes on them and see if it leads to an interesting discussion. And the first principle, this is on page 203 of his book, The Machiavellian Defenders of Freedom, at least in the edition that I have. There might be other printings. He says, an objective science of politics and of society, comparable in its methods to the other empirical sciences, is possible. Such a science will describe and correlate observable social facts, and on the basis of the facts of the past, will state more or less probable hypotheses about the future. Such a science will be neutral with respect to any practical political goal. That is, like any other science, its statements will be tested by facts accessible to any observer, rich or poor, ruler or ruled, and will in no way be dependent upon the acceptance of some particular ethical aim or ideal. Then he says, contrary views hold that a science of politics is not possible because of the peculiarity of human nature, or for some similar reason, or that political analysis is always dependent upon some practical program for the improvement or destruction of society, or that any political science must be a class science, true for the bourgeoisie, but not the proletariat, as, for example, the Marxists claim. Okay, I want to set this aside and go to the second principle.
There's a cut I want to say on just that one, but if you want to move ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Quite a number of things. First of all, if you're going to read anybody right off the bat, I would go with Burnham before anybody, literally anybody else, because otherwise I think you're going to get led down a lot of unproductive tangents. First, his contention about a science of power being theoretically possible. Now, I think that this is probably true in the abstract because, and he, first of all, he's a former Trotskyite, so he still shares this kind of reverence of progress and the idea that we know more than, say, Machiavelli himself did. I'm referring to Burnham's beliefs here. And you can imagine a science in which the art of governing as such could be studied if we had a real sociology, if we had a real anthropology, if we had real history. You could look at these things coolly and make judgments. And he proposes a way of measuring how correct someone's judgments are, which is the ability to predict what's happening next. And some of Burnham's predictions were wildly off the mark. Some of them, arguably the idea that the managerial class rules our society, remained true for a very long time. Here's the problem, though. Abstractly, I can say such a thing might be possible. But the reason why we won't see it is the same reason we don't have real sociology now, we don't have anthropology now, we don't have history now, because if you've gotten a degree or taken classes in any of those things, you know they're just bases for left-wing activism. I mean, you can't even really call them academic disciplines. It's just, it's a base for activists. And insofar as they create data or have a study or something like that, it's very obviously, with a very few exceptions, just what they wanted to see. I mean, it's like if a journalist contacts you about a story, like they've already written the story before they contacted you. I mean, that's how these things work now. And the line "the experts say" has become something of a punchline to those of us on the right, because we're so used to the idea of the science or the experts having an agenda of their own. And this is maybe the one thing about Burnham that we have to keep in mind. You're trying to rehabilitate a tradition, but the fact that it's been so marginalized shows the success of the opposite approach. Because Burnham is saying, when people moralize about politics, they're essentially lying to you and using it to cover for their own interests. And I think that's basically true. But moralism and this kind of absolute belief that this isn't just abstractly true, but that this must be morally true, and you have to go all out on it, and it's this shining ideal. You have to have that, because look at the historical reputation of Machiavelli, for example. I mean, Shakespeare was even using him as the epitome of all that was evil. So this is sort of the promise, but also the inherent limitation of Burnham's worldview, which is what he's saying by its very nature also shows the limitations of this approach.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting take on it. Yeah. Modern political science. Well, what's the difference between political science on his account and political philosophy? Or is political science on his account a form of political philosophy?
Well, I think he would have wanted to. Political philosophy, generally, you're reasoning from first principles. So, for example, if you believe in a doctrine of rights, you know, you would say, okay, we have rights. What are those rights? You lay them out. Then you kind of set forth the way you think things should be based on first principles. I think with political science, you'd be looking at things from the ground up, where it'd be more people believe these things. Why do they believe these things? Do they actually believe what they believe? The best work in terms of whether we believe there's even such a thing as free will or choice, you know, especially with something as important as the abortion issue. I mean, you can't even discuss those things without talking about propaganda and the role of elites in molding opinion, not just reflecting it. And leftists have done some good work on this, but I think you can see the obvious blind spot they would have about analyzing the tool that their power comes from. So, again, I think you could develop such a political science, but it would needs be so abstract from the human experience. And you would also, you'd either have to have this kind of split personality where, as a political scientist, you don't have any moral beliefs and you're just trying to figure out how things work. And then you're also a political activist or believe whatever you say on the side, or you just don't care about politics at all, other than just as a mechanism that you can unlock, the same way some people might look at, say, commodities markets or something. And I just don't think people like that exist. I think that the reality is closer to what you see in political science departments today, where it's just a way of being an activist and getting paid for it. I mean, mm-hmm. If you are going to learn political science, you're going to have to do it on your own through that kind of this dissident tradition that you can learn from. There are some online courses now. You can find people on Twitter who get into some of these different philosophers, or political scientists, I should say. But I mean, your best bet is just reading these books on your own, because you're not really going to get much from a modern university, at least beyond the underclass level, I don't think. I mean, I didn't find getting a master's really any different from undergrad. And in terms of where you actually went to find out how things actually functioned, I mean, you pretty much have to do it on your own.
Right. So principle two, he says, is the primary subject matter of political science is the struggle for power or social power in its diverse, open, and concealed forms. Then he says, contrary views hold that political thought deals with the general welfare, the common good, and other such entities that are from time to time invented by the theorists. So what are your thoughts on that? This is where I find myself diverging most from his approach. I can sort of say, okay, yeah, there can be an objective political science. I'm a little suspicious about what that is if it tries to abstract from norms. Norms are definitely something. Put it this way. You can be objective and still deal with norms. Norms are a fact. Treat norms as facts. Even if you want to just treat them as opinions that people have, norms are very powerful opinions that are facts in that sense. It's certainly part of the data of political science. And I think you can be objective about that. You can poll people, right? And you can try and find out what they think. You can be self-critical about your own polling questions to make sure that your own biases and agendas haven't crept in. Okay, that's conceivable. But the claim that basically what politics deals with, political science deals with, is the struggle for power, and that questions of things like the general welfare, the common good, these are normative ideas, and other such entities, as he put it, these are just inventions of theorists, and subjective political science can't deal with these sorts of norms. What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is where it returns to the limitations of his own approach, because he's right fundamentally that it is about power, and that power has to be at the center of any system of analysis on the dissonant right. When we talk about morality, we should always be aware that morality itself is a will to power. It is taught to you by certain institutions. It is reinforced by media power, which itself is reinforced by positions of power in academia and finance. But all that said, there's a certain inherent position in people where they have certain base desires. And while desire for hierarchy and power may be one of them, there may also be an instinctual sense of fairness or an instinctual sense of empathy or something that we would associate more with the political left. And you can't just deconstruct everything to the point where it's totally cynical, because it's not because I think that's such a bleak way to look at things. It's just I don't think that's actually true. And if you could do that, it would mean that a person would, hypothetically speaking, be able to objectively analyze oneself and determine why he does the things he does or why he believes the things he believes. I don't think a self-awareness like that is possible. And just like I don't think self-awareness like that is possible for the individual, I don't think it's possible for the species. I mean, let's not forget, Marxism, the great appeal of it at the beginning was that it was scientific, supposedly, and that it could explain everything that was happening in terms of class dynamics, that it could be explained rationally. But very quickly, once they started trying to put this stuff into practice, they kept running up with all these problems with theory when the theory didn't fit with reality. And then what they tried to do, and you could even see this sometimes during revolutions where they would say, oh, we're going from feudalism to communism, but we can't go too fast because we have to handle the stage in the middle first. They tried to warp reality to fit the theory. And I think any theory of human behavior has to have some room for the irrational, for the mythic, and a decent respect that what we take as sort of our inherent characteristics are partially genetic, but partially come from something that we will never fully understand. That's why my compliment to Burnham is a thinker who I don't think could be more opposed to him, which was Evelyn, because I think he gets closer than a lot of people to the root of things when he talks about the importance of symbols where sacral authority comes from, why we believe the things we believe. Without getting into some of that weird territory, you end up with basically a very cold science of politics that doesn't actually explain very much. I mean, again, Burnham did not really have a good track record as far as his actual predictions go. He basically got the overall system correct in essentials, but then as far as predicting what would happen next, he was basically wrong. And as far as his real life politics goes, if you say, okay, well, how do you put this into practice? I mean, as I recall, he was a Rockefeller Republican. So you can't even say that he was more right wing than some of the others. He had some bracing things to say about immigration and race by today's conservative standards. But I mean, heck, William F. Buckley used to defend segregation. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, yeah. My objection to this is something that I formulated when I was writing a review of Nima Parvini's book, The Populist Illusion. If somebody could link that review at Countercurrents, I'd appreciate it. Parvini basically rehearses a number of elite theorists, the classics, Michels and Pareto and Burnham and so forth. He talks about Sam Francis, and he says that the elite theorists show that populism is a delusion because a society is always run by a small number of people, and therefore the idea of popular sovereignty, which he understands as a factual matter that the people rule, is simply delusional. And my response to that was, you're missing out on the normative dimension of the idea of popular sovereignty. You can say that full popular sovereignty would be something like what Abraham Lincoln outlined, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The people are always going to be governed, and if they're governed for their own interests, that would be popular government, even if they're not governed by themselves. The essential thing about popular government is the beneficiary, who the activities of government are for. Are they for the common good of society, or are they for the elite that actually has the levers of power? Aristotle's Politics is based on a typology of different forms of government. And he says that there are two forms of government by one man. If it's for the common good, he calls that monarchy. If it's for the interests of that individual, he calls it tyranny. On the surface, they look the same. There's one guy telling everybody else what to do. If you have a kind of bullet-headed empirical approach to politics, those two systems are going to be the same. And the idea, therefore, of popular government would seem to be delusional. Whereas if you have a normative idea of popular government, namely government for the common good, that means that you can have government for the common good by means of one man or a few men or many men or a mixed regime that has elements of all three forms of rule in them. And that's an essentially normative understanding that seems to be just sort of shuffled out of this Machiavellian analysis. He says, well, we're just going to look at power. There are some people ruling over other people. And the normative dimension that would allow you to distinguish between a just monarch and a tyrant is just being dismissed as basically inventions of political theorists, constructs that are meaningless. I just think that blinds us to a whole dimension of legitimacy in politics.
Yeah, that's essentially my problem with Burnham. But I think that the fact that equality is always used as a weapon of political warfare, egalitarianism as a political weapon in Sam Francis's famous essay, and that hierarchy is a constant, and that when you hear egalitarian rhetoric, that's when you should be most alert to the dynamics of hierarchy and class and see who's cynically benefiting from it. That said, I think, as you say, Burnham doesn't really tell us much about how we get to define the good, other than saying, okay, well, he sort of comes at it with this doctrine of human freedom, where if we have different political forces with juridical defense, as he calls it, and others called it, basically, political liberty, you could sort of say, is the space that that exists between all these contending powers. And I think that's a healthy way to look at things. And 99% of the time, I get very exacerbated with libertarians who say things like, we're not trying to wield power, we're trying to abolish power. I think you can't do that. It's like matter, you know, it can't. Power always exists and it's always going to exist, and you can't wall it away. You can't wish it away. It's always going to be there. It's just going to be, and those who want to wield it are always going to triumph over those who won't. But you still have to have some concept of why you value the things you value, other than you've been brainwashed into it, or the media told you so, or everybody's an idiot except for me and only I see the truth. I mean, you have to have some idea about how you create normative values, because if it's just the conflict of sort of these like billiard ball type forces crashing into each other, and it's sort of just a question of social dynamics, the obvious response should be, well, then we really shouldn't care about politics at all. We should think of a better way to get more money, because ultimately it all just comes down to money and power, and caring about values or sacrifice or anything like that is a fool's game. And we don't believe that. And I also think humanity as a whole does not believe that, because people really do give their lives for things that have very little short-term material concrete benefit. And they really are willing to sacrifice on behalf of higher ideals. And they really are willing to take stands for things that aren't linked to short-term interest. So Burnham is a perspective, but I think he's more valuable than anybody else. It's just what he leaves out is ultimately the thing that makes us human.
Yeah, I think that that's well said. Point three, he says here, the laws of political life cannot be discovered by an analysis which takes men's words and beliefs, spoken or written, at their face value. Words, programs, declarations, constitutions, laws, theories, philosophies must be related to the whole complex of social facts in order to understand their real political and historical meaning. The contrary view pays chief attention to words, believing that what men say they are doing or propose to do or have done is the best evidence for what they actually do. Now, I hear this as basically his Marxism speaking, that, you know, ideas are epiphenomenal. They cannot be taken at face value. They have to be understood as part of a whole complex of social facts, as he puts it, that they have a real political and historical meaning, which has to do with how they function within the existing network of power or something like that. Is that basically how you read this?
I mean, he could be right. It's just, if you imagine a godlike entity who could conceive of all the differing social and political and biological forces that make people believe what they believe, and then act in society a certain way, and certain forces triumph and others are defeated. I mean, again, I can acknowledge that such a thing might be possible if you had sufficient detachment and intelligence. But this doesn't tell us the answer to the question of, because he talks about the formal meaning of an argument versus the real meaning of an argument. And one thing he talks about as an example, and I'm summarizing very broadly here, is he says that essentially the Napoleonic dictatorship delivered what most people wanted, what the middle class wanted from the French Revolution. And so all those high ideals ultimately just sort of boiled down to these practical things. And I don't know. I think that the people, I think Napoleon himself and a lot of the people who fought for him thought about things very differently. And even if you had some godlike intelligence that could perfectly analyze social relations, that doesn't get you behind what Jared Taylor is always lecturing me about, which is the mind reading fallacy, that you know what the other guy is thinking. It doesn't get to show you whether these other people really believe what they're saying. Because if you just assume that it's all cynical, and that nobody actually believes what they're saying, and that ultimately it all just comes down to class analysis or some sort of materialist thing, I think you actually are blind to the way politics does operate, because politics, like economics and like anything else human, has a very large and dark irrational element. And if you try to just explain that away as material forces, I don't think you can. I mean, one thing he says, for example, again, to use another one, this is from him, is he talks about how the doctrines of the early church, they thought they were debating theological differences, but actually what they were debating was what kind of religious dogma would govern the Mediterranean world. And it's like, well, I'm pretty sure the bishops who are arguing against each other in these very abstract theological ways, there is an element of real belief there. And you could say that this sort of class supported this sort of view of Christ, or this faction wanted this and everything else. But at some level, when people are talking about things this abstract and this divorced from the real world, there has to be some sort of real belief behind it. And there has to be some mystery behind it too. Because otherwise you start inserting causes that aren't actually there. And again, to return to what you said about legitimacy, if we talk about legitimacy and the acceptance of power, that too comes from a irrational source. I think Joseph Demetra said, humans don't respect what they themselves have created. This was in when he was arguing for superiority of monarchy. And I think we're kind of seeing that now, to return to what we started with the Supreme Court. We're seeing how the law is actually made. We're seeing, you know, Bismarck's joke about seeing the sausage made and relating it to legislation. There's nothing ennobling about it. It's very cynical. It comes down to horse trading and whether this person or that person is in charge. And what ends up happening is that the legitimacy of the entire institution leaks out, and people start looking for new sources of authority. I don't think there is still something called legitimacy. There is still something that forces people to go along with something even when they're opposed to it. And it's not just naked force, and it's not just even moral force or moral intimidation. There's something irrational that Burnham can't quite ever capture.
Well, he does say in principle four, logical or rational action plays a relatively minor part in political and social change. For the most part, it is a delusion to believe that in social life, men take deliberate steps to achieve consciously held goals. Non-logical action spurred by environmental change, instinct, impulse, interest is the usual social rule.
Right. But then you're just kind of explaining things away. And this is where you get like the Marxist false consciousness idea. Say some pro-lifers, you see them celebrating or something today, and they say, hey, we worked and we got this goal accomplished. I mean, what are you going to say? Like, no, actually what you really believe, because you were brought up in this way, is, you know, you think you believe these things, but it's actually this stuff. And then you try to do the same thing with the left. I just think it's a mistake to try to assign to other beliefs like the rationale for why they believe these things. I think it's sometimes it's very clearly there. You can certainly see how certain trends are less about morality and more about following fashion, for example, or getting some sort of immunity from being persecuted by the left or whatever it is. But you can't just deconstruct everything. I mean, that's also why the left and their whole academic system is not very impressive. And I think we're starting to see that now, as it's producing so-called scholars who are genuinely dumb. Whereas the new left of the 1960s, they may have been wrong, they may have been evil even, but you could tell at least they were smart enough to engage with the things they were trying to destroy. Whereas the people now genuinely are ignorant. But that doesn't mean they're just following some institutional thing. I mean, they do clearly believe in what they're saying. And it's because of that irrational power of belief that it maintains itself well after all the rational arguments for it have dissipated. And I think, you know, Burnham just saying like, well, it's because of all these factors they themselves aren't aware of. Maybe, but that's assuming that you are the godlike intelligence to decode all this. And that's a pretty broad claim to be making.
Principle five for him is, for an understanding of the social process, the most significant social division to be recognized is that between the ruling class and the ruled, between the elite and the non-elite. Obviously, that's an important thing. For me, though, again, going back to Aristotle, the things that can look very much the same, namely aristocracy and oligarchy, can be morally very different. But in both cases, there's a who and a whom. There's somebody ruling and somebody being ruled. But the essence of it is very different in the sense that the teleology is different. The legitimacy is different. The aims are different. So I think that that is an important distinction, but you can also say, fine, but does the elite rule for the common good or for its own particular interests? That's also a very important difference. In fact, I think it's a more important difference than the difference between ruler and ruled.
Right. I mean, you're basically arguing the question of, is there such a thing as the common good? Or if we don't want to be so limited to that, if we want to say is there some absolute good that leaders should follow, whether that not just the well-being of the most people or anything like that. Burnham doesn't really give you an answer to that because you can only see politics as the outgrowth of conflict between different forces. That said, the fact is most people get their vision of the good one way or another from religion. Most beliefs of this kind are essentially faith-based, even when people think they're not. I'm going to do what I just cautioned people against doing and say that 9 times out of 10, there is kind of a faith-based belief behind these things. It makes them feel good and it feels true in their heart, if not necessarily true in their head. But if you just say, we're going to see it as this mechanistic process, that doesn't give you a reason to oppose anything beyond self-interest, but that almost doesn't matter where we are now because the right is so powerless and the double standards are so obvious that one questions whether even bringing up double standards does anything at all, because now it's almost like the double standards are intended to be sent as a message by the system. As a lot of people say, it's not hypocrisy, it's hierarchy. And I think a Burnham-esque view would be very valuable here in sort of getting conservatives to understand that the reason to keep losing is because leftists have power and they're willing to wield it, not because we're not being quick enough and forcing them to live up to their own moral beliefs. I think that, and you know, that's like the famous Alinsky quote, like make them live up to their own book of rules. Well, what if the other side says they don't have to follow their book of rules? Then what? Because I mean, you're just assuming that either your morality has a force all its own, or in Alinsky's case, that you can basically count on guaranteed press support for whatever it is you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. But if you're coming at it from our point of view, it doesn't work the same way.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with the right is that so many of these people are deeply religious and really do believe that if they play by the rules, that there's going to be an umpire on high who's going to be giving them points if they lose gracefully, et cetera, if they make stands on principle. I don't think the left has that kind of faith in divine justice. They do believe, they do have a strong sense that history is on their side and so forth, but they don't seem to think that history is going to reward them for losing gracefully.
No, they have a greater sense in the belief of progress. I mean, I suppose that's a carryover from scientific socialism, but it's probably rooted in something deeper. They have a messianic vision that gives them strength. And I would actually identify this as a source of power, even though I think it's intellectually wrong. They can never conceive of the idea that they are actually in power, not even in fiction. They can never think of themselves as winning. There's no society they can point to where they can say, this is what we want. And if they do give an example, it might be an example that's something very short-lived, like the anarchist collectives during the Spanish Civil War. And even those were compromised pretty early. But I think almost the impracticality of the left is its strength, because they've always got this kind of burning passion against injustice and inequality. And because inequality is inherent to human existence, they're always going to be mad. And if you're trying to push society in the direction you want, mad people are going to be more effective than complacent people. I mean, the situation with abortion is very interesting because it's one of the very few exceptions, because, I mean, we see these people in the streets now, some of whom are making arguments about abortion that I think a lot of pro-choice people would wish they don't make, you know, bragging about killing kids, for example. But those people, they're going to be in the streets doing stuff, but they just suffered a pretty devastating defeat from people who, at least in my experience, tend to be the most well-adjusted, the most respectable, the most, how do I even put this? The people who are least likely to use force among the people on the American right. I can't tell you how many protests I went to when I in my early 20s, you know, doing whatever, and for various conservative groups, and you would see, you know, pro-lifers just getting the filthiest things thrown at them, just the worst insults, threats, and everything else. And what would they do? They would just say, "God bless you, I'll pray for you." That's it. Yeah, I never even saw a cross word being said by these people. Now, some people say that, you know, outside abortion clinics, there would be people screaming at them, or that they would go to some religious rally and people are getting hyped up on this extreme stuff. I don't think that's true. I mean, from what I can say from my own experience, the pro-lifers tended to be the most restrained of activists, but they still had that moral commitment. Maybe that's the difference, is that with the pro-lifers, they had a source of moral legitimacy that came outside the media and outside abstract political philosophy, because from a lot of them, it either came from their church or perhaps in addition to, they really thought that the pro-life case was the logical conclusion of egalitarianism. And so that gave them a strength and this sort of sense that they couldn't stop what they were doing because what they were doing was a morally absolute cause. That's something that conservatism by its very nature has a hard time with, because what do conservatives say? Don't amenitize the eschaton, basically don't demand the world. Well, the world belongs to the people who demand the world and who want the impossible.
Yeah, I think that's right. There is an astonishing lack of bourgeois complacency about the pro-life movement. I think part of the psychology of the conservative movement is this bourgeois complacency, is this delusion that you've discussed. It's in your book, Waking Up from the American Dream. The delusion that conservatives have that they are the establishment, that they are the winners. Well, if you believe in the pro-life cause, you cannot have the delusion that you are a winner.
Right. They never believed that. They never fell for that. And you could never, as long as Roe v. Wade existed, you could never even convince yourself of that.
Yeah.
And you could never even make claims like this is a Christian country or something akin to that, because that would be the first objection that would be brought up. And the fact that, as a lot of people are just now learning, that America's abortion laws were by most accounts the most extreme in the world in terms of an unlimited right for basically any reason, with no restrictions on when it can be done. A lot of the European leaders that were lecturing the United States yesterday had far more restrictions on abortion 2 days ago than the United States did. So,
yeah, exactly. I think that's very important in understanding the psychology of conservatives. The psychology of the left is that no matter how dominant they are, they feel like they're outsiders always fighting against oppression. The psychology of the right is that no matter how supine they are, how intimidated they are, how much they're losing systematically everything they're supposed to be conserving, they maintain the delusion that they're the winners, they're the insiders, they're the establishment. And a lot of American politics is just these two sides locked in these farcical battles, each side, helping the other side to maintain its delusions. The left, who control all the important institutions of society, still rail against the right as if they're the man. And the people on the right like to pretend that they're the man and that they really have the power, and they don't. It's a shockingly laughable system. Ultimately, it's just laughable. It doesn't pass the laugh test. It shouldn't even be analyzed. It just needs to be mocked.
Well, one thing that the left can say now, though, is in regard to this abortion decision, although a lot depends on the framing here, I think they could say with justice now that basically five justices pulled one over on the Senate and essentially said that they wouldn't repeal this stuff, when obviously they meant to, and hopefully they'll repeal a lot of other stuff. But I think it's not that the Supreme Court said, "Hey, everyone, abortion is illegal now." What it said was that the states should decide it, which was, and that the original Roe v. Wade decision was legally wrong, which was from a legal point of view, which is obviously true. Now, I think that conservatives need to be, take a step back. And I'm not even saying this as someone who is on the religious right, but as someone who is not against the religious right, say, I would be a bit cautious about celebrating, because all this means now is now there's 50 battles instead of one. And it's not just a question of getting five people on the Supreme Court. It's a question of holding on to that and also winning in all these different states. And it also brings up an important question about the question of vanguardism versus a mass party and political rhetoric and everything else, which is, I'm not going to say that a vanguard or a mass party have to be diametrically opposed tactics. I think any movement has got to have currents in it that are competing with each other and to some extent may even be opposed to each other, but they're different roads that lead to the same goal. The people in the movement don't even need to consider themselves part of the same movement a lot of times. And I think that if we try to say that this was just a playbook that was well executed by conservatives and by the religious right and by pro-life organizations, we risk ignoring the very real moral phenomenon that this is something you could, that never lost its popularity on a mass level in terms of the way you could talk about it, the same way opposition to, say, gay marriage did. Like, if you look at polls against gay marriage or against interracial marriage or something like that, you see a point where it was legalized, then opposition to it in the polls starts declining. With this, it's a little different. And I think it's because it's not that radical challenge to the normative political morality that this country has. Because really what you're saying is that this is a life and all people are equal, and therefore we are pro-life in all cases. Now, most people are not going to take that and say, well, therefore I am pro-life in all cases, including rape, incest, Plan B, all this kind of stuff. But most people are not logically consistent. I mean, the moral talking point is still what sticks with them. It's still what makes them willing to compromise on this kind of stuff. And I think the pro-lifers just had arguments available that people who are on the true political right really don't. And they use them the most effective way possible. And I was smiling when I was listening to somebody talk yesterday about it, because this was just somebody they were interviewing, some pro-life leader. And I remember literally being taught about how to argue the pro-life cause and how you always have to come at it from this egalitarian point of view, because that's the way to win over most people. And that turned out to be true. Now, I think as far as where we are, the thing that we need to normalize, even though it's something that, if you look at the polls, I think a lot of people are in favor of, which is scrapping all anti-white discrimination laws.
Yeah.
The fact that President Trump was called a white nationalist, even though he explicitly supported affirmative action and more race-based policies for African Americans while doing nothing explicitly for white Americans, I mean, it is remarkable. I mean, not only was he not a white nationalist, he didn't even favor equal treatment for white people. I mean, that has to be where we come from. And this is something we need to be aware of, because that might be one of the other Supreme Court cases that gets decided pretty soon too. I mean, there are all of these challenges going on with affirmative action. And of course, what may ultimately decide this is the fact that the system as constructed has a hard time discriminating against white people while also not discriminating against Asian Americans. What it, you know, what it clearly wants to do is have a system where you can discriminate against whites exclusively, but nobody else. But it's having a hard time putting that into practice, which is why you're seeing all this opposition to affirmative action in states like California from Asian parents who have their kids in elite institutions and then are told basically that that's a disadvantage when it comes to going to elite colleges.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very interesting. Let me move forward on Burnham. I want to pop back into Burnham for a couple of more points. In point five, he says the most important distinction is between the ruling class and the elite. Then point six, historical and political science is above all the study of the elite. its composition, its structure, and the mode of its relation to the non-elite. Contrary views hold that history is primarily the study of the masses or of individual great men or purely institutional arrangements. Then point seven, the primary object of every elite or ruling class is to maintain its own power and privilege. The contrary view holds that the primary object of the rulers is to serve the community. This view is almost invariably held by all spokesmen for an elite, at least with respect to the elite for which they are speaking. Among such spokesmen are to be numbered almost all of those who write on political and social matters. And then point eight, the rule of the elite is based upon force and fraud. The force may, to be sure, be much of the time hidden or only threatened, and the fraud may not entail any conscious deception. The contrary view holds that social rule is established fundamentally upon God-given or natural right, reason, or justice. I think this is problematic, and this is where his modernism is really showing. The primary object of every elite is to maintain its own power and privilege, which basically means that all governments are illegitimate in the sense that Aristotle talks about, namely they're not looking towards the common good of society, they're simply looking out for themselves. So basically all forms of government are illegitimate, in his view, by Aristotle standards, and that the rule of elites is based on force and fraud, which is another way of saying that there's no such thing as legitimate government, right? Because force is, you're forcing people to go along with things because, well, you don't have a good argument for them, but people accept bad arguments, right? But there's no real legitimacy.
Well, this is why I think it's maybe where we risk kind of divorcing ourselves from reality a little bit if we talk about ideas of the common good or a true legitimate political authority, because the fact is none of us know what that looks like. None of us have ever lived through it. I think every government in the modern age is there by both force and fraud. And when people bring in things like choice or public opinion or morality, I mean, again, this all, especially in a media dominated culture, this all flows from the top down. This is not, Aristotle was writing at a time when you still had to convince people face to face and you were still dealing with very low numbers of people. Now you're dealing with giant mass populations. I mean, just the sheer idea of mass and scale is fundamental to Burnham's thought. And when you're dealing with vast human populations that can be manipulated by vast media institutions, at a certain level, the arguments just stop mattering and it becomes a question of, well, who has the big guns? Because I do think that you can, if not a majority, you can get a pretty sizable minority, if not a plurality of people, to believe literally anything. And I do mean literally anything. I mean, if you said something as fundamental as school teachers are going to tell your own children to have a sex change if they vaguely bring it up one day, and they're also going to go behind your back to do it. That's the mainstream elite position now. And people who would have gone completely crazy at that idea just a few years ago now have an equivalent moral breakdown if you think there's something weird about it. And at the risk of being dismissive of a lot of people, I mean, there's something, barring radical change, barring, I mean, who knows, we are maybe in uncharted waters here, but if the culture keeps moving in the direction it's going, the sorts of things that are going to be considered that we acceptable in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years are just unbelievably rancid that to even name them now would be too much, but they will be telling us this is what we have to accept. And I'm not saying that you're wrong and that all political power is illegitimate, because at the end of the day, I do come back to Evola and his concept of sacral authority. But we have yet to see a legitimate political order in our lifetime. Even those things that, even what little legitimacy our existing system has, comes from us basically making something that was a very secular document, the Constitution, and something that was bitterly opposed in its own time, treating it as a sacred relic, something that is not to be tampered with. And to be clear, I think that that attitude is good, because if people lost their awe of the thing, we'd probably be in a much worse situation. But I mean, if I'm a leftist, I look at Burnham's arguments and say, yeah, this is exactly why we need to stop looking at the Constitution as anything other than the product of the political conflicts of its time. And you shouldn't be naive about that. If I'm a conservative, I say, well, let's take it even a step further. We should be cynical, not just of things that we got from the past. If anything, maybe we should be more accepting of those things. We should be cynical towards the absolutist morality preached today, because we should be questioning whether this is anything other than just an elite justifying its own position of rule. And I do think Burnham was right about that, that any political elite defines its highest goal as political survival. I think that is one of the universal rules that he may have exactly right, because even if people come to believe they know what the general will is, or that they're pursuing the best interests of the nation, you're always going to identify the person who can best do that as yourself. I think there are very few people who would say, I know what the general will is, and then if they're in a position to seize state power, they say no. I mean, I think the cynicism for our time and his modernism from our time is necessary. I don't think it's sufficient, because I think without something that actually is greater than life, something bigger than yourself, but not just in the cheap sense of some social good, but something that is an absolute platonic good that you're willing to go through hell for, and not just die for, but live for, which is far harder in a lot of ways. Without that, you're just not going to have the motivation to keep going. This sounds abstract, but it's really important to the situation we're in today, because there's very little you can offer people in terms of, if you participate in this movement, these are the short-term benefits you're going to get. And you can't even say things like, oh, well, I mean, depending on an organization or something like that, you might be able to say things like fraternity or brotherhood or something. But really, that's more dependent on the way a group is organized than the ideology itself. I'd say that the only concrete thing that where we are, where we can offer elites, is sort of this sense that, hey, wokeness really does eat all human accomplishment. I mean, it really does make any kind of upward development in technology, in medicine, in social organization, in every aspect of public policy, it really does make anything productive and possible. And so you have to oppose it. But I don't think a lot of elites are going to fund something like that out of the goodness of their hearts until it comes for them, or until they really see it as jeopardizing their own position. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I just think that this is an incorrect understanding of the behavior of the people who are running our society now. The people who are running our society now are not trying to maintain their power. They might think that they are, but they're not fundamentally succeeding at it. If you want to maintain power, then you make rational decisions to increase your power. And you have a sense of limits. You have a sense of breaks. You have a sense of, okay, this is something that's going too far. Maybe we need to tap on the brakes, right? I don't see any sort of higher governing intelligence to the people who are running our society now. I see moral hysterics. I see a kind of moralistic id, if that's not a contradiction in terms. It's a crowd psychology. It's the psychology of a crowd that's hopped up on certain moral principles, if you will. But the thing is, and they're competing with one another. They're struggling with one another to prove that they're more virtuous, and to, you know, to one up one another in terms of this hierarchy of values that they've got of wokeness. And they are one-upping one another. They're crawling over one another, trying to overthrow one another in certain ways. They're constantly plotting against one another. But at the same time, the position of the establishment as a whole depends upon whether or not it can deliver certain deliverables. For instance, not get involved in a global thermonuclear war, not cause a spectacular crash of the economy, not cause violent revolution and blood in the streets. And they seem to be incapable of avoiding these terrible consequences that could ultimately destroy them and the whole society.
That doesn't mean they're being irrational. It just means that they could be wrong. Political elites fail and new political elites come to power. I mean, it's not, it doesn't necessarily prove what he's saying wrong. I would just say that there was an article not long ago, and this led to a kind of a lot of celebration on social media and stuff about the left eating itself and how in any kind of left-wing community now, you have this genuinely toxic spirit because everybody, as you say, has to always be one-upping each other. So they may be your comrade today, but tomorrow, if somebody says they tweeted something bad 4 years ago or they said this or whatever else, I mean, you have to be willing to freeze them out entirely. And that's actually making it hard for some progressive institutions to operate, particularly when people are incentivized to make charges of racism or sexism or transphobia, whatever invented moral sin there is, so they can move up the ladder.
Yeah.
I mean, for better, that's one problem we actually don't have to deal with. Now, one thing I would say, though, is that I wouldn't necessarily assume that they're driving themselves into destruction, because there are a lot of assumptions being made here about, well, the left is going too far now. But even if the Republicans come back in 2022 and win a historic victory, it's not like they're going to reverse any of the things that have been put in play since Trump was essentially driven out of office and since George Floyd and everything else. They're not going to put back the Confederate statues. They're not going to repeal Juneteenth. They're not going to change these cultural norms of the Black national anthem before a football game or the new intersectional flag, which goes beyond the rainbow flag, like all these kinds of things. They're not going to defund any of the organizations that make any of this possible. They're not going to throw local DAs out if they refuse to enforce the law. I mean, these are all the things that would be required just to get back to where we were a couple years ago. And maybe they're calculating wrong. Maybe they are about to make a system breaking mistake. But if they are going to make that mistake, I don't think they're going to make it in terms of managing the American people and managing domestic political opinion. Even if you have a short-term Republican victory, I think the broader trend, they're right that they are winning. Where they may screw it up and it may destroy the whole system, unfortunately, it will destroy a lot of other things too, is either A, in foreign policy, where I think we've just got some genuinely deluded people in some pretty high positions, and also when it comes to the economy, where wishful thinking tends to be punished a lot more harshly than it is in social policy. Because the thing with social policy is if you control the media sufficiently, or I don't want to say control the media, but if you control a sufficient number of media institutions, because we should look at it almost as like controlling fortresses or something. It's like that static and that territorial. If you have that power, you can pretty much get enough people to put up with anything. But if you can't literally deliver the goods and you run into a Soviet style problem in terms of satisfying domestic consumption needs, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to lose your power, but it raises the possibility. As I said before, I think we may be in a situation now where we've got the first real generation of people who have been educated by the true believers, by the woke, by the people who never even had to engage with the things they overthrew. And as a result, you have people who really don't know how to behave in any other way other than essentially a parasitic way, where you make moral claims and manipulate language, and then you expect to get a job and a lifestyle as a reward. Well, that system has worked for a very long time, but if there starts being serious resource scarcity, and more importantly, and as I think is happening now, if the United States loses its position as the dominant global power, those assumptions just aren't there anymore. And I think now we, for the first time, we may have an elite that is too incompetent. It's not that they're too extreme. It's not that they're too nice, or, you know, they're not being ruthless enough or not being ambitious enough. I think they are extreme. They are ruthless. They are willing to go a lot farther than they're going now. I don't believe you can underestimate that at all, but the competence may just not be there anymore. And the assumptions and all the social capital and also the economic capital that they've been drawing on for 40 years is just gone. I mean, even with something as simple as, okay, we're going to supply weapons to a foreign ally because we don't want that country politically expanding. Well, America doesn't have the factories to produce the kinds of munitions in sufficient supply anymore. It's not like World War II, where the USA could be the arsenal of democracy, because frankly, all the heavy industry has been exported to other countries. We saw similar supply chain breakdowns with all the COVID shutdowns. And the fact is, we're still seeing it, which is why prices are so high and why this country doesn't build any new refineries, which is why gas prices are going to be so high, regardless of whether they get rid of the tax or not. So these basic questions of competence and the way the economy should work, I think our leaders just sort of assume that America gets to be number one forever just because. That may be coming to an end, but then again, maybe not. I mean, you can run on inertia for a very long time, and I wouldn't overestimate the chances of our current ruling elite falling from power anytime soon. As I always say, I'm a long-term optimist, but a short-term pessimist. And I think their control now is much more solid than it was in, say, 2016. I think our potential audience is bigger. I think that the amount of people willing to listen to our message is bigger. I think the number of activists moving in now are coming in without any illusions, and that's a good thing. But it's still going to be an uphill fight for the next couple of years. I have no doubt in the inevitability of victory, but I think that the idea that it's all going to come crashing down and that right soon, I don't think it's going to be that simple.
Right. I have a couple other questions here, and I would like to get your input on them. ABC sent $5. Thank you. He says, Google's Lambda system seems to be sentient, according to Google engineer Blake Lemoine. If this is true, is this good or evil? Just the creation of this system? How about its destruction? I don't know what to think of this.
I read the story. It's a pretty broad claim. I mean, it's mm-hmm. essentially like, are you sentient? Yes. Oh, look, we created something sentient. Well, okay.
Yeah. I would abort all artificial intelligences. Figure out what the hell's going on.
It's not going to work that. I mean, at this point, it's sort of like saying, can we limit nuclear proliferation? Like, on a long enough timeline, the answer is no. I mean, we're probably going to see, I mean, we're already seeing AI from the left is already having to grapple with this, because what do AIs do better than anything else is
they notice.
Yeah. Pattern recognition. And so they keep noticing patterns and saying, hey, look at this pattern. Like, oh, well, you're not supposed to know that pattern, but if you're a machine, you don't know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to dumb down the artificial intelligence.
Right. That's basically what's happening. And, you know, again, it comes back to the question of, let's suborn the AI question to the question of, is the ruling elite ever going to be forced to recognize social realities in terms of these patterns we see emerging in terms of crime, poverty, family formation, you know, the kind of policies we should be pursuing as opposed to what we are pursuing, all these kinds of things. And I don't think they will be forced to confront these things unless they miscalculate on something else at the same time. I think they can keep the population repressed more or less indefinitely unless they're challenged by an external source. Now, the question is that everything that we see as inevitable liberalism, as modern progressivism, all of that relies on, the United States of America being the world's sole superpower and supporting all these other institutions. And I don't think that is necessarily going to be true that much longer. I think that the U.S. has kind of burned up a lot of its international legitimacy over the last few years. And, but I could be wrong. I mean, it's the main challengers to the United States are Russia and China, and there are very good reasons to think that the political leadership of both those countries are less secure than they make out, and that the economic problems are also much greater than made out. With Russia, obviously the question is whether the Russian military can achieve its objectives and who succeeds Vladimir Putin if he's sick, which of course we don't know. That could just be American media speculation. And the bigger question with China is the economy actually performing as well as they say it is? Because there are a lot of good reasons to think that it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Archie writes in with $5. In a tweet on June 24th, Michael Savage warned that because Roe versus Wade was overturned, most women from the center will vote for Dems and that the Republicans are destroyed. What are the pros and cons of that outcome? First of all, do you think that that's a valid prediction?
That depends on how it's framed. I mean, I think that 70% of the American people supposedly said they did not want Roe to be overturned. Now, the question is that going to be the thing they vote on? Because if you say, is that your most important issue this fall? A lot of that 70%, their answer is going to be no.
Right.
Secondly, the question is whether... I mean, if you're talking like short term, maybe, but I don't think it's actually going to have as big an impact as people think in terms of this upcoming election, because what ultimately happens is people are going to figure out is that it reverts to the states. So deep blue areas are still going to be able to have as many abortions as they want. That's not going to change. And if anything, you're going to see more ideological sorting. Now, maybe you could say, oh, it will force people in states like Texas, if you live in Austin or something like that, for example, it's going to mobilize these progressives. Maybe they'll be able to win like a big Senate race or be able to flip the governor's house or whatever's happening. I would just say that not this year. I mean, this year, the brutal reality is that you can win people over and you can force people to say what you want them to say a lot of times. But in the privacy of the voting booth, I mean, most people really don't think much beyond how they're doing personally. And the fact is most people economically were doing a lot better under Trump than they're doing under Biden. Biden doesn't seem to be doing anything to help them on that. And instead he's talking to them about January 6th, abortion, and Vladimir Putin. And if you're a working class family that is struggling to pay the mortgage, which just went up because of interest rates and everything else, or if you're somebody who doesn't even own their own house because you can't pay the rent anymore, frankly, I don't see why you would turn out for the Democrats or work hard for people who, in your view, haven't done anything for you. And, you know, we could say, oh, well, this is gonna get suburban women who may have been coming back to the Republican Party, you know, who Trump had turned away, but now they're coming back. Now they're going to leave again. Again, maybe, but in my view, the question of how women vote, it's less a gender gap and it's more of a marriage gap. And the kind of motivations that affect single women and the kind of motivations that affect married women with children, or even single women with children for that matter, they're very different. Because you could just as easily imagine suburban women not being thrilled about the kind of political radicalization that's going on at the public high school, and all of a sudden becoming a lot more favorable toward once fringe ideas like homeschooling and school choice. I mean, how extreme was homeschooling 10, 15 years ago? I mean, we do have to think that I think we're right that, you know, Cthulhu always swims left and in terms of the way society goes, but we shouldn't be completely blind here. I mean, 30 years ago, the weapons laws were more restrictive than they are now. If you think of homeschooling, that was a much more fringe position. I mean, you didn't homeschool. People would say, you know, you don't homeschool someone because they would be asocial and a freak. Well, now you look at the people that they're turning out in public schools. Basically, there's a very good argument to keep your kid at home because they'll be better socially adjusted and you won't have like lunatics trying to use them as a tool for political agendas. And that's not, you know, me fringe right winger saying it. That's like normal decision people of all political persuasions are having right now. And COVID, of course, accelerated that too when the schools closed. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, a lot of the things that are happening now, things, broadly speaking, are still moving in the wrong direction. If things continue going this way in 10 years, everything will be worse than it is now. But we shouldn't be blind to the fact that under the surface, there have been some big movements. And if there's an opportunity, that may express itself in interesting ways, particularly if the Supreme Court becomes delegitimized to the point where the center of American politics starts coming back to states and regions, which would be, frankly, closer to what the framers intended than what we have now, where we essentially have a very elaborate system to try to get a majority of a ruling body with nine people on it.
Exactly. Okay. Reed Johnson has sent in a $10 super chat. It's also possible Roe v. Wade is now being overturned because somebody among the elites figured out as a numbers game, repealing abortion will now hurt rights more effectively and efficiently while also reanimating leftists as a bonus. What does our host and guest think of that possibility? I don't think that's very likely.
That it was deliberately engineered?
Yeah.
No, I don't think it was deliberately engineered. I mean, the demographics of the situation are reality, and we have to think about, if you take a step back and you start saying, okay, what does this mean if people with severe developmental disorders, Down syndrome, for example, where the, correct me if I'm wrong, and I truly apologize if I'm wrong here, but I believe most women who find out about that ahead of time abort the fetus. What are the social ramifications if all those people are required to bring them to term? What are the racial ramifications if abortion is banned in the South and these populations start reproducing more quickly than the white population? The big question is that it's not going to be one thing. I mean, it's going to have to be something that we look at state by state. And only then can we sort of draw a picture of what the long-term effects of this could be. Now, right now, you could say, okay, Alabama has banned abortion, so therefore, this is going to have a bad effect in terms of whatever demographic group you don't particularly want to see surpass the others. But then you could also say, okay, well, Utah has banned it. And so are we going to see more white families in Utah? The fact is, population demographics and reading that into the future is very tricky. And one of the things that's been very surprising over the last few years is how quickly the fertility rate has declined among populations that move to the United States. And we should also remember that in terms of fertility and in terms of who's having kids and who's not, white Americans are having more kids than what we would consider the most developed Asian countries, South Korea, Japan. And you can't say it, or at least maybe somebody can, but I would find it very hard to believe that South Korean media and Japanese media are teaching self-hatred and having no kids to people in those countries. You can't just blame it all on the media in this case. I think there's something inherent to modern life and the economic incentives that have been built into it that is really moving things here.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, I get where people are coming from with the abortion thing, especially in regard to race. And I get the arguments. I know that a lot of you could find people on both the right and the left who are going to accuse people on the other side of the abortion issue of being eugenicist. And everybody is right and everybody is wrong simultaneously. It's just really a question of like how specifically it's going to play out. And I guess I would conclude with, well, the first thing I said was that the best thing you can do is start thinking about what it'll take for you to be able to not just have a family, but also raise a family in the kind of subculture and the kind of area that you think will be healthy. I don't have any illusions about, you know, being able to shelter your family from the modern world entirely, and kids ultimately end up making their own decisions. And if you try to like brainwash them, I think that ends poorly. But the fact is, we do have a certain amount of autonomy from the system. And all you have to do is look at different religious subcultures in this country who are getting along just fine even with all the hostile media propaganda in their face. So, mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately we can overcome this kind of thing, and the future is not written in stone, even when it comes to something like population estimates, especially when something like population estimates.
I have a question here. Eric has written in. Okay. He has a movie question. Favorite Arnold Schwarzenegger movie?
Conan, but you know, Commando. I almost consider Conan not to be an Arnold movie. Yeah. It's its own thing. But as far as Arnold movie as a genre, which I think is a defensible genre choice, it would obviously be Commando. But as far as the best movie he was in, Conan.
My favorite movie with Arnold in it is, first of all, I think the first Terminator film is a classic. I really like that film. I also really enjoyed True Lies. I had a good time with that one. Conan is a mixed bag. I really wanted to like it, but the trouble is that I was hoping it would be Robert E. Howard's Conan, and it was something else, something very different. It was done too ironically for my taste, and that kind of bummed me out. I have a review of Conan in the most recent Trevor Lynch collection, though. Eric also wants to know if Trevor Lynch is going to come back. Eventually, Trevor Lynch is going to come back, but Trevor is taking a vacation because Greg Johnson is writing a book on The Great Replacement. And I just decided that I needed to take the time that was going into 26 movie reviews a year, or actually 24 movie reviews a year, and put it into writing this book. So eventually Trevor will be back. I did get a question. Let me see here. This is from Lovecraft's Cat. It's also a Trevor Lynch question. Will Trevor Lynch review The Batman or Jurassic World Dominion? The answer is no, not as such, not in print. I will give you a few quick thoughts on The Batman, the Reeves Batman film, and Jurassic World Dominion. And Greg, if you've seen these, the other Greg, no, the other Greg, Gregory Hood.
I haven't seen him, so I'm
okay. Tripping on okay. That. Okay, well, The Batman, I thought, was surprisingly good. I thought it was worthy of being discussed in the context of the Nolan films, which is kind of hard to believe. I found it a little too long, though. I think it needed to be edited a bit. It's nearly 3 hours long. It just can't sustain that. I thought Robert Pattinson actually looked better in the mask than out. He actually looked more dead in this than he did playing a vampire in Twilight. He has a sort of goth emo look in it, which I don't think is particularly appealing, but I thought he was good in the role. I thought it was in many ways a good film. I just wish it had been a little tighter. I thought Michael Giacchino's music was actually good and much better than the Hans Zimmer music in the Nolan trilogy. So it's worth seeing. It's actually worth seeing. And there's some extremely effectively done scenes. This is especially seeing it in the theater. I usually yawn and, you know, look at my watch when a car chase starts. I was absolutely riveted by the car chase scene. In this, especially when I saw it on the big screen, it was quite remarkable. So there are certain things about this film that are very highly accomplished and well done, and I thought highly of it. Jurassic World Dominion, I really liked the first Jurassic World movie with Chris Pratt in it. I think he's just a very cool guy. I thought it was a good movie. The second one was pretty good too. This one brings back the cast from the original Jurassic Park trilogy, Laura Dern and Sam Neill and Jeff Goldberg or Goldblum, or I forget which Jeff it is. And honestly, I didn't want to see these people ever again, dinosaurs on the screen. And because these characters were brought back and they had to create a plot that integrated the new cast and this old cast, it became overly complicated. And it just lost a lot of dramatic cohesion, and it went on about 25 minutes too long. If they had just cut these these dinosaurs out, I mean the human dinosaurs out, and just focused on the CGI dinosaurs and the new cast, it would have been a highly entertaining film. But they kind of messed it up by doing the nostalgia thing, by bringing back Han Solo and Princess Leia, although we didn't care about these characters in the first trilogy, right? It was calculated to do the nostalgia thing, but nobody missed those people. And so they just junked up an otherwise pretty promising film. It is interesting, though, the villain is basically an autistic Silicon Valley type, although he's not in Silicon Valley per se, he's in genetics, but he comes across that way. And I think it's kind of an interesting, cool villain type. So anyway, those are my thoughts on those films. Let's see if we have any other. Okay, Archie has sent another one in with $3. This will be our last question. Biden blamed Trump's appointment of 3 conservatives to SCOTUS for the Roe v. Wade conclusion. Will this cause the court to be expanded and the Constitution to be attacked? What are your thoughts on that? Are they going to try and pack the court?
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution preventing them from packing the court. It's just been kind of a political norm, sort of like presidents should only serve 2 terms. And Roosevelt was able to get away with breaking one of those norms, but not the other. Ultimately, the only thing that prevents the Democrats from doing that is the outcome of the election. And this year, it doesn't look like they're going to have a very good year. Now, perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps hysterical media can get enough progressives out there so they can limit some of the damage. Perhaps they can use their usual tricks to try to do whatever with the election outcomes. And I'm not referring necessarily to anything in terms of fraud, but just the usual try to turn out the people in certain areas and then redraw districts or do whatever else you got to do in terms of last minute legal filings to try to push the numbers as best you can. I think that if they have the ability to do it, which is perhaps what you're really questioning, yeah, they will. Why wouldn't they? There's nothing standing in the way. And I think that the media would celebrate it and say the right operated in bad faith by having these justices essentially promise to uphold Roe v. Wade and then they didn't. So the only thing that's going to prevent them from doing that is not just Republican victory in the House, but you probably have to get some of the Senate races too. And frankly, the Republicans aren't looking too good in a lot of these Senate races. I think that the GOP has a pretty good chance to take it back the House, but I am not too confident about the Senate. And as we've just seen, you know, with this unbelievable and completely unnecessary gun control deal that for the Republicans did with the Democrats, I mean, the Republicans just can't get out of their own way. I mean, all they had to do is just sit there and do nothing. And just talk about, you know, just talk about the economy, and it doesn't matter. Like, what do you think about, you know, whatever other issue, and just be like, well, gas prices are really high and that's terrible. I mean, just keep saying that over and over and over again. But now you essentially have the left fired up on a cultural thing, and you might say, well, that's okay because the right is fired up. But with the gun control thing, you just told probably the most independent constituency you have next to the pro-lifers that you're not going to do anything for them, even if you get into power. So that's a pretty big defection in what may end up being a turnout election.
Right.
Most of these things in off years come down to the base. They don't come down to swing voters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think you're right about that. So folks, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We've had a good live audience. We've had some great questions. Thank you for the donations. I want to thank the folks in the chat. I want to thank our moderators for being very helpful. Of course, I want to thank Greg Hood for being the star. Greg, how do people follow your work?
Well, at American Renaissance, obviously, amrad.com, Greg Hood, and then also James Kirkpatrick at vdare.com. And that's about it right now. So I don't have any independent operation other than that.
Great. You're well worth following. Folks, tomorrow you should tune in because on the writer's block, we have Richard Houck. Nick Gilvey and Richard Houck are going to be talking about a play by Yukio Mishima called My Friend Hitler. It's about the Rome Purge. And they will also, of course, talk about current events and your questions. I'm going to tune in. I'm very, very curious to see what these guys are going to cook up about this play. So I think it'll be a lot of fun. That will be at this channel. It starts tomorrow, 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 o'clock Central European Time. So please tune in to the Writer's Block tomorrow, and we will be back next Saturday with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.